This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Twyla Tharp was once described as the most remarkable departure in American dance since Isadora Duncan rejected ballet shoes. Dance critic Laura Shapiro said of Tharp's choreography, "It's not ballet, it's not what we think of as modern dance either. No agony, no hard edges, no pristine leotards. This movement is made up of shrugs and shudders, quick slides and lightning-fast changes of direction." Twyla Tharp has created a dance vocabulary based on ordinary movement, and she's choreographed dances to music by Fats Waller, Jelly Roll Morton, The Beach Boys, and David Byrne. Some of her best-known dances were created for Mikhail Baryshnikov. When he was director of the American Ballet Theatre, she joined him as artistic associate. Now they're on tour together, performing her dances. Tharp has written an autobiography named after one of her dances for Baryshnikov, Push Comes to Shove. In the book, Tharp writes that as a child she worked in the drive-in theater that her parents ran in California. She told me what that was like.
Well, first of all, it was against the child labor laws, so that whenever any of those folks would come, having had word that my mother had an 8-year-old working in the snack bar, I would be hidden in a back room. So I got from the very beginning the idea that something pretty exciting and illegal was going on here. That was the first aspect of it. Secondarily, it happened at nighttime. So night, which is illicit to most children after 10 or 11, became a time when I had to kind of fight to stay awake because we were still doing business. And third of all, it was in a way very insular because it kept me away from children my own age and from participating in those kinds of games. On the other hand, it put me in a position to watch. From an early age, I had the idea that one of the most potent places to be was an outside objective viewer, whether it was an audience watching a movie or whether it was a person, as I say in the book, who has to calculate what the audience thinks so that you get in behind the snack bar before you have a rush. So I think more than children ordinarily do, I developed a sense of myself as an objective, judgmental force rather than an emotional participating one.
Well, you not only got to watch the movie and got to watch the audience, you also got to watch the movie watching the audience. You got to watch the movie not watching the audience and making love in their cars. What was it like for you as an 8-year-old to see all this stuff happening?
Well, I'm not sure that I actually, when I was 8, was roaming the ramps, but I certainly was by the time I was 10 or 11 or 12. It just became, you know, a regular way of life. I suppose it's the same. I mean, this is being very extreme, but I suppose it's the same as children who are around, other sorts of illicit sexual activities as business. It becomes just, you know, a matter of course.
Let me quote something you write in your book. You say, "The art of 50s movies was sustaining forever the moment before sex. They were a great big come-on, arousing without satisfying. I sensed early this perpetually suspended condition could be translated into art." Do you feel that you've translated that into your dance?
On occasion. I don't think this is a negative thing. I think it's really quite an extraordinary thing. It's a source of great energy, and energy is one of the largest components of my trade, how to manage it, how to generate it, how to control it, how to enlarge it, how to bring it down. It's called pacing. And I think that this sense that I acquired of, you know, it's manipulation, and it's one of the tools in any director's craft bag. And that having it brought to such a clear, literal, black and white, two-dimensional form with the movies and with the ratings at the time made it a very interesting way of understanding about sublimation and code, because really that's what it was. It was talking language of a sort in code, and that's what art is. It's a code of sorts.
Let's talk about your dancing lessons. When you were very young, you started at the Vera Lynn School of Dance. You learned tap dancing there. Then you went on to study with a French ballet teacher. What were your childhood impressions of each, you know, of tap and of ballet?
Well, I think the biggest differentiation was not so much in the styles of dance themselves, because to me, again, it was all about energy, but in the ways in which they were presented. The Vera Lynn School of the Dance had little recitals, and we put on reviews, and, you know, we did quick changes backstage, and we went from toe shoes to tap shoes to numbers with ropes to numbers with hula skirts, and it was all about entertaining an audience. And then when I entered the more classical worlds of the dancing, it became less about connecting with the audience and more about presenting something that an audience could applaud only from a distance, not connect to so immediately. After all, we all kind of can connect with a hoofer, but those ethereal beings in point shoes are rather more difficult to become, excepting for 5 and 6 year old girls.
Did you feel that you fit into ballet? And was there a point in your life when that was what you really wanted to do?
I never fit into the ballet. I never felt that I did. And it was never something that I really thought I would be doing.
Why did you know early on that ballet wasn't for you?
Because it was a lie.
Ballet was a lie?
In the sense that its technique was very valuable and very exciting from the waist down, but from the torso up, the rules were artificial. There was not an engineering necessity. The choices were made by style, which to me was a lie. Engineering was the truth. If the body had to work that way and it was the only way that made sense, then I understood it. But if it was an option, then whose determination was it that was making the choices?
So you felt you were fitting yourself into some predetermined style that didn't make
any
sense?
Which I never liked to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, you studied with Martha Graham for a while.
Only a year, very, very, very brief time.
In your book, you write that she often required dancers to play roles, and you couldn't imagine yourself being anything except who you really were. What were the problems that caused for you with Martha Graham?
Well, only that while I loved working in the technique and I had the highest regard for her and the company, I didn't understand the acting that was the basis of her art. So again, to me, as with the ballet, her medium was a lie for me, even though it was clearly a complete commitment and an absolute truth for her and the people that worked with her.
Now, you've talked about other forms of dance feeling like a lie to you. How did you start to find your own sense of truth in dance?
By trying to get back to fundamentals that I could not negate in any way, and without which one could not move. So, I mean, taken very literally, I could sometimes, as I did in the early years, sit hours in a studio, not moving at all, unless I felt I had no option but to try such and such and so and so. Now, I must say that these odd 20-so years later, I wonder at such stubbornness. But on the other hand, now when I go in to a studio and I have a facility because of the number of years and the number of hours that I put into these empty spaces, I sometimes have to question the directions that I take and say, is this inevitable? And that really was the first question that I set out to ask. Is this step that I take, and will it be with the right or the left foot? Which direction is it going to go in, and does it absolutely have to be that way, and under what conditions does it absolutely have to be that way, so that there would be no question, and it would hopefully therefore have what at that time I didn't know I was really trying to deal with, but comes down to the issue of universality. Would it be something that could be common to many of us?
When you were trying to find the inevitable movements and the basic movements, did you come up with movements that were very much like normal movements, you know, like walking or jumping or, you know, just the kind of movements, like dance versions of movements that everybody does in the course of an ordinary day?
Yes, I think I came up with probably what are some pretty stupid things if you want to know the truth. I also think that they were probably pretty limited, and I think that, I mean, I know that they were very limited, and that it was a little bit like a person learning to speak who stutters. And that the words are aborted, and that nothing has a follow-through, and is very choppy. It was, I was fighting so hard against allowing for the possibilities of movement that anything that worked its way out really had to work very hard to get out. Movement was very tentative, and yes, certainly in the beginning, it was often aligned to what we call the mundane movements, the walking, the running, the skipping, and that sometimes, because at the same time as I was working in a studio saying, where do we begin here, I would also still be studying particularly the ballet. Whenever I would feel anything from the ballet vocabulary start to enter into the dancing, I'd say, uh-oh, hold on, this feels like it's a glee, so I'd get that out of there. I wanted nothing that already had a recognizable name to it. So if it came to running or skipping or hopping, I somehow had to trick myself into believing I had invented that. Now, don't ask me how, but for a few years, I really allowed myself that amount of liberty, and then I got on with it.
When you feel a ballet gesture creeping into your work, do you feel as totally rejecting of it now as you did when you were younger?
Well, it depends who the dancer is and what the dance is. If it's intended as a ballet, for ballet dancers, I'm rather grateful, if the truth be told. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Okay. But there are still moments where I'll say to myself, oh, ballet, yucky. Or I'll say, this is not American. Or I'll say, this is not fundamental to human movement. Or I'll say, this is elitist. Or I'll say, that's pretty excellent. Let's use it anyway. Or I'll say, sometimes it's like I look at it like figure skaters. It's elaborate. It's Baroque. It's beside the point, and it's wonderful.
Right. Okay. During your early years as a choreographer, you were married, and your husband was an artist, something of an avant-gardist. From reading your book, it sounds like he taught you a lot, but on the other hand, you felt at some point that he had a set of rules that one had to maintain to be a serious artist or a true avant-gardist, and that started to feel really cramping to you after a while. What were those restrictions that you felt his kind of philosophy was placing on you?
I'm not sure that I can be absolutely specific about it. I will try. At the time, the movement was minimalist art, and in the beginning, the work that I did certainly fit into that category because my inclination was to try and find the basis of movement. So I was perfectly happy to start with these, as I call them, rudimentary building blocks, the ABCs. But as I worked more and more and more and tried to include more and more and more and make it relevant and expand the work that I did from the inside out, it began to feel as though I was betraying the minimalist ethos. And also, at the time, it was very much in the air that, to use an expression of the time, that artists were, in a way, political, and that their art made a statement. And I found myself less and less interested in that. I simply wanted to make the art. And that began to feel as though it was an issue. And then, of course, there is the business of art for the sake of art, and the purists, of whom Clifford Still was the most extreme example, completely leaving the art world and, you know, moving as far north as he could get. And I, on the other hand, being in a live art form and also having been trained as a child to take into account the audience, found this somewhat unnatural and became more and more interested in what an audience thought, to use performances and the proscenium stage as a laboratory for researching what went through an audience's mind and where I did and did not see parallel with them. And this, too, seemed out of place in the 60s avant-garde.
My guest is choreographer Twyla Tharp, and she's written a new autobiography called Push Comes to Shove. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Choreographer Twyla Tharp is my guest, and she's written a new autobiography. You got pregnant before you were married, and when you were pregnant that first time, you had an abortion. You didn't feel ready to have a child. What were your concerns about becoming a mother then, or being pregnant then?
Well, I think that the first question is the appropriate one, and would be the same one that I think any woman would ask today. What does it mean to be a mother? And I did not feel at that time that I could be responsible to the degree that I would believe necessary and also continue to work. And I did not feel that the time was right for me to stop working and that the two simply could not be simultaneously accommodated.
When you did get pregnant and decide to have the baby, were you concerned at all about how the pregnancy, you know, how carrying a child would affect your dancer's body?
I was, but I decided, and I think it was a very good decision, that I would not let this divide my life, and that I would include the baby in the dancing. So I continued to work right up until I went into the hospital, but each day would be a different way of working because my body was different, and I have trained myself to ask myself to grow up along with my body growing up, and that was a very valuable period of time. I mean, to be literal about it, for example, the way in which the body's proportion shift forces your center of gravity to a totally different place. And continuing to work during that period, I had the rare opportunity to experience this and to relish it so that instead of demanding that my body do things that it did when it was not pregnant, not carrying a child, I really tried to investigate as much as I could the things that were unique to it at the moment.
Is there anything that you still use that you learned then? Any kinds of gestures that came out of that?
I think a sense of weight that came out of that I will always have. There is some videotape. I managed to get a video camera during the course of that year and recorded about 22 half-hour tapes. One can clearly see a shift in how weight is employed, and it's a sensation that I remembered long after the fact, still do.
After the birth of your son, Jesse, you say that you felt your work needed to start reflecting the male presence. You had choreographed for women before that. What was different about choreographing for men?
Well, I think that clearly men and women are very different beings from the point of view of what they can accommodate physically. Men traditionally have been faster, stronger. That they occupy an arena which makes, in most sports, mixed doubles very uncomfortable. Competition happens best amongst men and women in separate categories, basically speaking here. And as a choreographer beginning, I wanted to investigate the possibilities of the female. Also, as I say in the book, I didn't want men intimidating us with these possibilities of more power and more speed. I wanted us to feel that we were working at an absolute edge, and therefore we set about to do so for 5 years until we came to a point where we felt we knew ourselves and our potentials fairly well, and then we could see what the male imperative might be here. And as I write in the book, the mix of men and women I thought would probably have a big impact on what our subject matter was, which was also true. Recently, in order to address this issue of the difference between the male and female physical potential, I've started doing a lot of weight training. Not that I think I'm ever going to challenge any of the male, you know, power bench or squat records, but I have found that believing that I'm pushing my body to my own max affects very differently how I can relate to men. And I think that was the point of our early experiment, was to believe that we had gone as far as we could, not with somebody looking over our shoulders who perhaps could get a little higher or go a little faster.
Tell me a little bit more about how working out with weights has kind of changed your sense of what male dancers can do.
Well, no, it hasn't since changed my sense of what male dancers can do, because most men who dance don't do weights. What it has provided me with is an upper body strength that allows me to do a very different kind of partnering than most women can accommodate. It allows a different sense of the total body conditioning and a different kind of stamina than most women have. I mean, I work in gyms where there are serious weight trainers. I mean, my trainer does 550 pounds on the bench, and, you know, it's not unusual for somebody to do 800 pounds squatting. This is a lot of weight. They do over a ton on the leg press. I mean, this is, like, real.
As you get older, and you're what, in your early 50s now?
All impossible, both of the above, yes.
Yeah. So are you changing the movements that you're doing yourself?
Certainly not. I'm working harder. It's just like the pregnancy. Growing older means the body is changing. It does not mean the body is deteriorating. To me, it means it's altering. I insist upon looking at it that way and realizing that there are new lessons to be learned every day from a body that's different.
How much are you dancing now?
I work, an hour of gym work, weight work, then I will do a bar and sort of improvisational work for another hour, and then the performances, which are, an hour of dancing or so.
You write in your book that your energy used to come from competition, victimization, seduction, and fantasy. Where does it come from now?
Well, those all sound like they're good, don't they? let's see. Where does it come from now? It comes from a sense of having tried a lot of things, knowing that it's knowing the difference between caffeine energy and the energy that comes from a body profoundly rested and prepared. Very different things.
Is there any part of your body that's in distress now?
That's an unfair question. I think that anybody who works always has a portion of their body in disrepair, and that is an absolute necessity.
Okay.
I'm teasing you. I wish that I could see you, because sometimes I hope my tone of voice is giving you a certain set in the mouth, which you would know means that this is supposed to be funny. No, I'm not in any particular pain, any more than any dancer ever is. Every dancer always has something that is kvetching.
Right. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Twyla Tharp's new autobiography is Push Comes to Shove. She's touring with Mikhail Baryshnikov and will be performing in Fort Lauderdale, Miami Beach, West Palm Beach, Indianapolis, and Pittsburgh in early January. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.